A good new year, and this is the last meeting, and we're done with our work.
not quite.
Early in the new year.
Last one from the January meeting.
Yes, there you go.
Actually, as soon as Lee Byer is here, he's kind of queued up to run this meeting, and we're just going to get started and go through, as it says, item number one, sort of routine business. We're a little late getting started, so does anybody have any kind of an announcement or anything they'd like to make before we get started? We all know each other pretty well now. So let's do a roll call.
Let's go ahead and just say your name and who you're with, or who you're representing, again, if you are representing anybody. Again, we're recording the meeting, so that way I can keep track of the minutes. So let's go ahead and start here.
I'm Greg Mitchell. I'm standing in for Bob Parker tonight as your helpful consultant.
I'm Beth Goodman with Echo Northwest.
David Reeser, City of Springfield.
Doug McKay, Commercial Property.
Dave Moore, DC Real Estate for the Springfield Board of Realtors.
Danny Eagan, Springfield Chamber.
Johnny Kirschman, Planning Commission.
Mike Kelly, Citizen.
George Greer, Lane County Farm Bureau.
Donna Lentz, President.
Steve Yet, Developer.
Got to be super Avalon Center.
Phil Farrington, please help.
Right on time, Mr. Byer. I'm going to turn this over to you. Or just haven't reviewed the minutes yet, but that's where we are on the agenda.
So everybody had a chance to review the minutes. Any additions to the minutes or changes? I don't see any. Move on in. All right, next item we have is public testimony. Is anybody who wishes to comment? Well, Ms. Goodman, so we're done with that one.
What a fast meeting.
I like those. All right, so now we're back to the third item, review of the EOA, the Economic Opportunity Analysis. David, are you doing this?
Let's see. We are on the, actually, item number two is legal review of the adoption process.
I'm on the agenda for 2 minutes. I'm sorry, I got the wrong thing out. Wrong one in front of me. Legal. I got it now? I said it's the wrong one on top by the last time's agenda.
So if I can just add in for a minute. So tonight, for this next agenda item, we have Al Johnson with us representing Springfield, as well as Mr. Bill Van Vactor, who's sitting in back here. And they're going to take us through this next hour over some of the legalities of population forecasts, as well as going through the UGB expansion process. And some of it there may be technical, so feel free to ask questions. I think we're going to have Bill go first. That's our email.
That's fine. Is there a way to run the?
Yep, I will help you.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I've been an Oregon resident all of my life, and spent about 35 to 40 years observing Oregon land use, and Al Johnson is kind of the preeminent land use expert, in my opinion, in the state of Oregon. So I'm going to make my comments very brief, so that we can have almost all the time for Al, and I do have for just a couple of minutes on the safe harbor population forecast. As I suspect you have already been briefed, under LCDC Goal 14, population forecasts are the foundational determinations predicate to considering a possible change to an urban growth boundary. Obviously, when you move an urban growth boundary or even evaluate it, you need to make a determination for the future, that 20-year forecast that you've heard quite a bit about. In Oregon, counties are responsible for the preparation and maintenance of, in quote, coordinated population forecasts. And keep that word coordinated in mind, because I think that's going to be a significant issue in the future as we move forward. in Lane County many years ago, the responsibility for preparation of that forecast was delegated by Lane County to the Lane Council of Governments. But there's been a lot of activity statewide that I suspect that Al is going to brief us on and we'll learn about today with regard to this issue. And cities in Oregon were having trouble moving forward with their UTB analysis because they didn't have current and useful population projections. So they went to the 2007 legislative session and got the legislature to adopt a safe harbor methodology that you could use that essentially is formula-driven to determine cities' urban 20-year forecast. And there's half the lie. I'm just going to blow right by it. The second part.
Just to show us that you had it there.
The formula has been worked through, the numbers calculated. And if you see under there in 3A, if the coordinating body does not take any action on the city's proposed forecast, subsection 1 and 2, within 6 months after the city's written request for adoption, the city may adopt the extended forecast if, A, the city gives notice and to the other local governments, and the city includes the adopted forecast in the comprehensive plan or in the other documents referenced in the applicable comprehensive plan. So that is the path that Springfield is on. As the 2007 legislative session handed that opportunity to cities, and then on February 13th, Lane County government chose to rescind its delegation of authority to Lane Council of Government to prepare population forecasts and essentially reclaim that authority. Then on May 19th, the Springfield planning staff presented to the Springfield City Council options with regard to how to determination of population forecast predicate to all the work that you folks are helping with regard to House Bill 3337, and the City Council directed that the City of Springfield use the safe harbor approach because it was a process that was timely and it was certain to occur. In other words, it happens by, if you follow the formula, it happens by operation of law, which can prove to be very beneficial in Oregon with regard to land use. So on June 25th, the mayors of Eugene Springfield sent a letter to Lane County Board of County Commissioners informing them of the city's request to use the safe harbor. On August 20th, the Lane County Board of County Commissioners contracted with Portland State University to develop a coordinated population forecast for all of Lane County, because there are other pressures with other cities in Lane County. Unfortunately, however, their completion schedule doesn't call for them to be completed until December of 2009. So as you can see, a little bit out of sync. The City of Springfield has a directive under House Bill 357 to do certain work by a certain date. Yet Lane County's coordinated forecast isn't even scheduled for completion until virtually the same time that Springfield is to be completing its work. We have been coordinating with other local governments in Lane County and with the City of Eugene, as well as DLCD. We've had several meetings with the director of DLCD, where I was convening those, Mr. Johnson. They've been very beneficial. And on November 4th, DLCD stated in a letter that the June 25th letter was an appropriate request of the Safe Harbor statute, and that the methodology used to calculate that forecast met the standard in the statute. So, as we like to say, on December 25th, Bill Grau got his Christmas present in that the 6 months ran on that date, and Springfield, after our appropriate notice to other Lane County local governments, we now adopt the safe harbor forecast into the appropriate planning documents. So procedurally, legally, where we're at, I know you have seen this data, but just to kind of recap what the safe harbor forecast predicts for Springfield, 2029, the population of Springfield in its urban growth boundary, our portion, 80,027 folks, 2030, 80,843, 2031, 81,602. So that is the path we're on. Those are the numbers. And if you have any technical questions about the calculations under the formula, Greg Moss is a living expert on that subject matter, as well as other folks in the room. But as I promised, this very short presentation just to explain where we are regarding the population. Any questions?
Who was that challenge? By the county or anything else?
Well, we will obviously go through a process of coordinating with the county on this. We will find out. You know, we think very strongly that we have...
It's our standard legal answers. Everything is challengeable. The question
is, we think the statute's clear. We think we clearly complied with it. And, you know, our effort has been, seriously, has been to coordinate as much as possible with the city of Eugene, the city of, and the Lane County. We have regular meetings with all the appropriate staff there. So hopefully there won't be any reason to challenge it.
If the coordinated forecast comes in significantly different than 11 months, what's the city's responsibility?
Well, at that point in time, assuming we've done the final two steps, which is we inform the other local governments and we have adopted an appropriate document, we would have an option, of course, of kind of changing the current process and perhaps pursuing that. But we would also have the process of staying in the safe harbor forecast, because it would duly follow the appropriate process. And the problem, as you see, is under House Bill 337, Springfield has a lot of things to do by December 31st, 2009. So it would be, if they are significantly different, you know, the practical consequence might be to just stay with the safe harbor forecast and present the plan at that point in time to the state for approval, rather than change things. Because it is a foundational sort of document. If you change your population forecast, then you're going to change a whole other series of assumptions. And I don't know how to weigh in.
Well, the only, I agree with what you said, Bill, the only additional thing to address is that the other reason that we are doing the safe harbor is that signs are that there's a very good chance that somebody involved in coordinating the population forecast will be unhappy with the outcome of that process. There's a good chance that that figure will be tied up in appeals and litigation for some time after the end of 2009 with this adoption of the fine. And so during that entire time, everybody will be in limbo, except those who have got to the safe harbor process. The statute isn't really 100% clear on, it basically says that we can use the safe harbor for purposes of our urban growth boundaries, projections and whatnot. It doesn't say that we can't switch and use that for the other figure for other purposes once it becomes something of natural life. I'm kind of guessing the difference. It's not going to be a huge difference between the two numbers. It's just that one's going to be one we can count on, and the other is like less likely in the near term. Does that make sense, Bill?
Yeah, I agree.
So I'd like to make a comment. I think some of you are familiar with the fact that the safe harbor population forecast will be used in the housing needs analysis, which was conducted with a different committee. So we haven't talked about that much in this committee. This committee is focused on economic land needs. So we'll be bringing the results of the housing needs analysis in terms of land need to this group next month, the month after, later this month.
Okay, and that's as clear and fast as things are going to be.
Thanks, Al.
Sorry. Well, actually, I know that you've got a gorgeous set of 20 maps or so that Dwayne Winterow can't wait to show you, and you can't wait to look at during the second half of this meeting. And so I'm going to just talk until our time is up. If it doesn't take that long, you get the bonus time, but I'm not going to go over it. If I start to, I want to be reminded. What I've got here basically is a simple slide at the beginning, which is about the adoption process. And then a kind of endless series of slides, which is a book's tour of states' urban growth boundary controversies that are currently of interest to us for a number of reasons. Actually, in a lot of ways, Oregon's Springfield is... timing isn't bad because we are about a year behind the city of Bend. We're a year or two after Woodburn, Bentonville, some other places. There are a number of folks out there breaking snow or track or whatever it was that are getting us some information that's useful. And what I try to do is pull together, there's nothing really authoritative that you can count on in the way of rulemaking on a lot of these issues. But we do have some feedback in several forms. We have some LUBA decisions in some of these cases. We have Court of Appeals decisions in a few of these cases. We have letters, comment letters, objection letters from LCDC. We have some LCDC decisions. And we have some briefs, like LCDC defending decisions in the Court of Appeals in some of these cases. So there are several of these cities out there. The ones that I'm going to talk about tonight are going to be Bend, Woodburn, Adair Valley, which is a tiny little place up outside of Albany, but it happens to be important for a number of reasons. And Minville, mainly because it's such a sad story. They've been doing this forever, and the tar baby is right over there. Greg can tell you all about it. How many of your kids have put through college? It's kind of amazing. So we'll get into that, but we're going to go with this words to the first slide here, which is the UGB adoption process, which is what the agenda actually says I'm supposed to be talking about. And what I want to talk about is how the UGB process works when you get to the decision point, when there's a final adoption and goes on to the next level. Most of us are familiar with the two basic routes of land use decision making takes now. Posting on that are legislative. One happens in periodic review. The other is what is known as the PAPA process, which is for post acknowledgement and plan amendments, which happen outside of periodic review. And the PAPA process is one that takes you to the Land Use Board of Appeals. And it has several advantages and a few disadvantages. The advantages of going to the Land Use Board of Appeals are that they have very short timelines, that there's no state review unless somebody proactively initiates a petition for review. The Land Use Board of Appeals makes its decisions basically talking about the issues, says this is what isn't right. It doesn't give you much guidance on it. Doesn't tell you exactly how to fix it. It simply says what you did isn't right. Here's why it isn't right. We're sending it back to you, and you fix it any way you want to fix it. And somebody can appeal it or not. You just go on. The Court of Appeals decision process is similar there, and both the Court of Appeals and the Land Use Board of Appeals are in very, very short timelines. Things happen quite rapidly. The downside is that sometimes you get into kind of a loop because you get so many little bits of information on each decision that you may go around 2, 3, 4, or 5 times. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen. It's a little bit like being falling into a washing machine. You don't want to do that. The periodic review process is one we're all familiar with. What you get there is a lot of guidance. You get automatic review by the Department of Land Conservation and Development. They give you very specific feedback, and they have the power. It's been certified, it's been established by the courts that they really have the power to pretty much tell you exactly where to cross your T's and dot your I's. It's micromanagement, and from the highest authority we've got so far, it's something they can do. And the other major significant thing about periodic review is that there's nothing periodic about it. It just goes on and on. And some of the, what I've done when I talk about these four cities is to talk about the issues a little bit, but also I've got a timeline for each one, so you kind of see how they work. Some of them just went through one process, some went through the other, you kind of get a feel for it. One of the odd things about periodic review, a lot of people like the idea of periodic review because the idea is you can get a piece of what you're doing, take approved, and you can rely on that for the next step. Well, that's not true. It just isn't true. They can change their minds. They do change their minds. And the downside of it is that the legislature allows each of those incremental decisions to be appealed to the Court of Appeals. So it's not just the final decision that goes to the Court of Appeals, but any decision on the work task can even have the word cast, but partially approve a word cast. You might have 12 word casts, potential for 12 appeals to close appeals. And when you go to the Court of Appeals, there is no time limit for the Court of Appeals. Yes, they have 60 days, the opponents have 60 days of the LCCDC's decision. They have 60 days to file a petition with the Court of Appeals. But at that point, all bets are off. There's no requirement for Court of Appeals to make a decision in a particular amount of time. There's not a specific requirement for the agency to get its record together. I've had experiences in urban growth boundary expansions where the LCDC has lost the record for a year. We just went through something, my partner in the Woodburn case, where the comment is just getting the record together and being resubmitted about a two-year process. And, you know, once the Court of Appeals finally hears argument, it can then take as long as it wants to make a decision. So, and that's just on a work task within the process. So, with what we are doing here, what the City of Eugene and the City of Springfield are doing, and Lane County are doing in conjunction with each of those cities, is to do this urban growth boundary expansion outside the periodic review. So that makes it look like it's probably a PAPA process, and that's partly right. We follow the post-acknowledgement process. We don't have to go out and develop a work program, which is another two-year process, at the beginning of the thing, and get that approved by LCDC. We don't have a series of work tasks. We simply file a notice, do the hearings, adopt the decisions, and then the time needs to run. However, after we adopt, after either jurisdiction adopts an urban growth boundary that includes more than 50 acres, and that's a weird bit of language in the statute. People think what it means is adds more than 50 acres to the boundary we've got right now. LCDC interprets it as involved in anything that adds up to 50 acres, such as 25 in and 25 out. Some people say there's no such, there aren't any decisions if you're adopting your urban growth boundary for the first time, just we are, all of NRs will include that. So if there's any expansion at all, there probably will be some expansion of the Springfield boundary and probably Eugene boundary as well, however modest it will. Instead, after it has been adopted as a PAPA, it will then be submitted by statute that goes to LCDC. And what the statute says is that review by LCDC is in the manner provided the periodic review. And that kind of doesn't throw us completely back into the periodic review situation. We're not a series of work tasks. We've got everything done there. But it does mean that the agency will probably have the ability, if it doesn't like something, to be pretty specific on how it wants that fixed. And it probably will be quite a bit pretty specific about how that gets fixed. And if there are appeals, whether it's by property owners in the city or agency or interest group, those appeals will go to the Court of Appeals and will have, they won't be the fast kind of appeals, you get the Court of Appeals unless there's a change in the statute. There's some talking. So that's basically what happens at the end of the process. In adopting an urban growth boundary, it's been the case since the goals were adopted that every urban growth boundary has to be jointly adopted by the city and the county. All HB 3337 changes is that this time around it'll be the City of Eugene and the county doing one project, and the City of Springfield and Lane County doing the other one. It has to be co-adoption.
Now, what happens if the county, or has, let me ask you, has there been any history where a city prepared the comprehensive plan and the county just refused to adopt it?
Yeah. In fact, I raised that issue when there was a ruling a couple, 3 years ago in connection with the safe harbors, and with Bob Rinney, and he said, well, it's never happened. We wouldn't expect it to happen. We have a, you know, we're assuming that's not going to happen in this situation. We have a good working relationship with the county, and we've had no indications that they have any interest in doing anything but making sure that HB 337 is properly implemented and done in a timely way. There may be some differences of opinion over the details of it. If they do something, I would assume that they would take their actions based on substance rather than just inaction. So I think that'd be very unlikely.
What if there's a dispute between the two parties?
There is no established dispute resolution mechanism for that. Over the years, going back to the adoption of the initial UGBs, there's been informal processes. For example, in Jackson County, when the first set of boundaries were adopted, there were disagreements between Jackson County and several cities about their renewal boundaries. The jurisdictions all agreed that they would submit their positions to LCDC. LCDC would indicate its preference, and they would, if they felt those preferences were at all reasonable, to be abide by. That happened. It's not going to happen in every case. There have been situations where there have been disagreements, and what can happen is that theoretically, one jurisdiction could get an enforcement order against the other to take some position. But again, they're conflicting positions. You simply don't have a coordinated boundary. In the first round, the effect of it was that neither the county nor the city had a valid comprehensive plan for that area, and there was a set of consequences that went with it. The goals applied directly. Here, I think the consequence would simply be that the existing metro plan and rural comprehensive plan would continue to apply as currently acknowledged, and I think that would apply separately on either side of the city of the I-5. So, for example, if Springfield and Lane County get to the finish line first, Eugene and Lane County will continue to operate with the existing system as an acknowledged system until they get to their Eugene decision. So it isn't that the world comes to an end, but again, it's not something that courts and legislature or anybody else will solve. Any more questions at this point about that? Okay? All right, so the next slide is a little perspective on urban growth. This is a wonderful website from the University of Oregon's planning department's website that is interactive. If you go to the website, and it shows various urban growth boundaries which were in the form of masonry in Rome, going back to 350 BC and coming down to 1990. And as you can see, it's not exactly the kind of thing where you can extrapolate a lot of trends from time to time. The numbers there on the side, I thought it was interesting that between 44 BC and 100 BC, between 100 BC and 44 BC, that's about a 60-year period, Rome doubled in size. You get to 400 when the Goths showed up, and it halves in size. No, it goes from a million down to 80,000. Doesn't get back up to the levels of antiquity to about 1931, and now it's about twice those levels. Urban growth boundaries were pretty important in those days. They had a somewhat different function, but not entirely. This is a picture of Rome in 1551, and the town is kind of huddled over in the northwest corner there. The rest of that is what's known as the Inabito, I think is the term. Some of these Italians better than mine, but basically where all the ruins are. Here's another interesting thing that boundary or urban growth issue. This is in the current issue of archaeology. It's an interesting story about a jurisdiction which chose not to grow onto the farmland. But at that time, we didn't have a global warming or a coastal goal, apparently, because in the past 400 years, most of the bluff has worn away, and so most of the city is now in the North Irish Sea. I actually have an urban growth boundary situation down in Brookings, which is somewhat like that, because we had to avoid the Harbor Bench, which is a wonderful piece of urban agricultural land. And so it's basically enclosed as a little island. And the urban growth boundary was expanded up onto a bunch of hills, whereas it turns out there's no money to build roads. Okay, just to have them here to refer back to, you've all been through the Goal 14 location factors, and these are what are talked about in the decisions we're going to be looking at. And what the Court of Appeals has said is that contrary position was taken by some of the more rigid interpreters, I guess, of the priority statute, is that there is an interaction between the statute and the goal 14 factors having to do with efficient accommodation of identified land needs or the provision of economic services and that kind of thing. You don't have to apply the priorities in a way that is completely irrational. Those are the goal 14 factors. These are the need factors, you're familiar with those. The suitability criteria are very important because that's where you kind of set out your initial characteristics of the kind of sites and land you need. I know this committee has been talking about specific site needs for specific kinds of targeted industries, and that's something a number of other jurisdictions have done, and that comes up in the litigation we're going to talk about. And then the issue of establishing that what you want to do isn't something that you can do by reconfiguring, densifying, or making other changes inside the existing development is an issue that comes up. I just want to call out a key term in the statute, the priority statute. You all know the four priorities. I think good farmland is the lowest priority. Exception lands and reserves are the highest priority for bringing in. There's a set of exceptions to that in the statute itself. The term inadequate physical constraints are sort of key issues because there's always an issue as to whether streets or rivers or hills or other kinds of features, natural, artificial, or physical constraints that allow you to choose a lower priority land, such as good ag land, over a higher priority land, such as non-resource land or exceptions. Okay, the first town I want to talk about is Deer Village, which wasn't even a city when the goals were adopted, but it is now. It's a little bit of town, a former military camp, I think, training facility, west of Albany. And they have a little arrow there, and it's right on Highway 99 West. Did a little Google map thing of it, which shows that the existing village is mainly on the east side of Highway 99. If you look to the south, you see some good agricultural land, which is where they want to expand. If you look to the northwest, you see kind of a blotchy area there. That's an exception area. And the issue in this case, this is kind of their timeline. Deer Village is one of the speedier little guys around the block. That's partly because it's a small community. I had one large landowner who could basically bring in his property to address what we normally do with a bunch of properties in bigger communities. They did a pop-up. They had an application filed for an expansion in 2006. 2007, they adopted the pop-ups. It went through the Land Use Board of Appeals. It found some flaws. The Court of Appeals found more flaws, but that only took a year. Back in February 2008, summer 2008, the city fixed everything, as of December this past month, the Land Use Board of Appeals affirmed one of the city's two fixes. The other major fix, the city readopted its urban growth boundary, that is currently before approval again. So again, we're going to go through two cycles, but from 2005, they could be done, if they got it right, they could be done. By the end of the middle of 2009, there will be a decision from LUBA, and by the end of 2009, there will be a decision from the Court of Appeals. That's 4 years of two rounds of appeals. It's pretty fast. Okay.
How come this went to LUBA, given that they're adding 143 acres instead of the LCDs?
I believe that they did something before that took effect. I really don't know exactly why, I know what it is. The statute applies only to jurisdictions over 2,500 population. That's it, okay? They're a little guy. Little guys get to run, through the chairlifts. So, the key issue in this case, I want to go back for a moment, I thought, had to do with the question of physical barriers. The the city made the argument that there was a physical barrier that warranted going on agricultural land. The physical barrier is Highway 99. The cost of boring under, just boring the holes under 99 West for their sewers and water and whatnot, was found to be prohibitive. And the fact that they'd be split by 99 would basically create a wall down the middle of the city and prevent it from being a village, prevent it from being a walkable community, prevent it from working as a small village it is now. They wanted to keep it all on the east side of 99. The Land Use Board of Appeals and Court of Appeals both found that was an adequate justification for going to a different priority. And I think that's important because that is not a particularly stringent test. Nobody was arguing they would have had to, you know, bridge the Lamb or the McKinsey or anything like that. This was a substantial less of a barrier for that. Now, there may be a question of proportionality here. You know, maybe they would say, well, you know, heck, Springfield, Highway 99 should be a problem for you. That's probably the case. But still, they rejected the idea that barriers have to be natural barriers, and they accepted basically good planning argument for that. So that indicates there's some flexibility out there. You lose a little freedom, but you get some flexibility. They did. Well, they also found, however, that the city goofed was in accounting for land they had available within the existing city. Everything's at a very small scale here. It revolves around 15 acres. And they accounted for 4 acres of it, which was occupied, or going to be occupied by a church. But they didn't explain what was going to happen with the other 10 acres. And so, Court of Appeals and Lubin made them go back and count about 10 acres. So, you know, it's all relative. Okay. So, next city is Woodburn. And Woodburn is, I think, important for this committee in particular because the issues there involve almost entirely economic and, I mean, commercial and industrial lands, primarily industrial lands, and the how that interacts with the priorities process. Both Greg and I are involved in the Woodburn case, but my partner is handling that. I'm not going to speculate on what the outcome is going to be, just to identify some of the issues. Where this case is right now is that the LCDC has approved an urban growth boundary expansion. It has been appealed to the Court of Appeals. As I told you, the briefing schedule, the record summary schedule, was very drawn out. But the briefs have all been filed. Oral argument will be this year sometime. Decision probably in 2010. But what we have in this case that I think is extremely valuable is an LCDC, Justice Department brief, defending LCDC's decision to approve the city's decision to go on to some good agricultural land west of I-5. For reasons that relate to targeted industries, access to intersections, transportation issues, a variety of kinds of things that were seen as being sufficient to apart from the priorities. There are also a number of supply issues. So just very quickly, you can see the soils there, some of the best soils are up in the northwest, but some good soils are down in that area 7 in the lower left-hand corner, and the expansion area is mainly off to them, is mainly there at on the southwest side. So it's mainly on to the good class 2 soils. Friends of Yamhill County, I believe it is, and 1,000 Friends would prefer that the city expand onto other soils, which I think are to the south, which are not so good. So there's a lands inventory. Again, the kind of maps you guys have got. If you look at the diagonal at the left, you see a I-5 is the coming down west, the southeast, sorry, northeast, the southwest, and you'll see those diagonals behind the intersection. There's a big warehouse facility, and that entire area right behind that warehouse facility that's striped is very good agricultural land, and that was identified as needed, as was the land for the south, which is good. The UGB is fairly aggressive. It adds almost 1,000 acres. The plan period is 2020, so because of the various delays they've already had, it's definitely not going to be a 20-year growth boundary. They have fairly substantial forecasted growth. Process, as you see, began in 1997. The LCDC approval was January 2007, most recent LCDC approval, January 2007, and now it goes to the Court of Appeals, and so we're going to be basically a 13-year process with their law. There is the whole long, sad story. Okay. All right, so there's some issues, and I think it's worth going through a few of these because I think it'll help you as you look at it's pretty pictures in about half an hour. Key issues are the LCDC earned accepting Woodburn's use of a targeted energies methodology and accounting for capacity and employment land existing UGB. Can a UGB include more land than is actually expected to develop for commercial and industrial uses within the 20-year plan period? And finally, the choice of land. Petitioners argued that the LCDC did terrible things. It included far more land than the city's projected actual need for these uses in the next 20 years. It included some of the best farmland in Oregon, and it skipped over suitable lands inside existing UGB. They argued that LCDC misinterpreted the short-term land supply rule, so supply required by the Gold Line rule, by treating it as, in some cases, being additive, whereas Thousand Friends argues that really, under the rule, short-term land is simply a subset of total 20-year land supply. They also didn't buy Woodburn and LCDC's market choice analysis, arguing that that's what the 20 years is for. Finally, they argued that LCDC and the city erred by failing to link the chart of the analysis enough to adopt a 20-year population forecast. Arguing that basically Goal 14 creates the same kind of linkage for under Goal 9 as it does for housing under Goal 10 and the residential lands statute. This was the thing where they just, you know, were not enough evidence and just letting the city off with flimsy excuses. And then finally, this city's criterion of 2 miles is very, very important. As an identified need for targeted industries, there were a number of studies showing that it is important for these various industries that the city wants to attract to be within 2 miles of the intersection. But apparently, they say it shows a preference, not a necessity, and it's too weak. So LCDC filed a brief, and this is what is really useful, because this is the kind of thing that LCDC can cite to the LCB when we're arguing. So it's a good thing to have. First, LCDC argued that Goal 14 doesn't require job growth estimates, unlike residential growth estimates, in proportion to population. It argued that the 20-year need determinations, write the statute, they're just, effectively needed. And then they laid a lot of emphasis on both the economic goal statute. There's actually a statute backing up the goal, backing up Goal 9, that was adopted in the mid-80s because there was a sense in the legislature that Goal 9 wasn't getting enough teeth in it compared to, say, Goal 10, Goal 3, and Goal 4. And so it uses the modifier at least adequate supply, and the rule says the same thing. They point out that the land needed to attract industrial developers over the 20-year period may be different from the amount they actually develop, plan to develop. So it's got to look at what the
these target industry people are going to want to buy in the data site. They're going to lose the city of Springfield. I mean, these businesses of Springfield. The whole idea is to be Springfield. Okay, so, and what they go on to do is talk about the concept of a site needs approach rather than what Thousand Friends wanted, which is one that's based upon employment growth. And it said Woodburn had a legitimate need for industries that made it less of a detriment and give higher wage jobs close to home and commuting times. Okay? There's a transportation advantage there. And that it is not an area thing anymore, it's a population thing, it's about the types of sites industries require. And 014 allows them to do this. So, and then its final point, I hope it's its final point, is that an adequate depth that UGB can include more than 20 year supply if it's necessary to assure adequate short term supply and sufficient market choice among sites. They're not saying that short term supply and market choice are automatically add ons for 20 years. They're saying that in some cases it can be shown, and here it was shown, that the 20 year supply did not actually completely include all of the short-term supply as a funding rule, a single funding choice. They, again, said the city is not required to use median growth rate or strict employee per acre methodology. A lot of things they say the city is not required to do, and you remember that when we are talking to them about this and other issues. Talks about what their theory is. And so then we get to the selection issue. It was, first of all, it says it was all right for them to exclude existing vacant buildings. It was all right for them to exclude partially vacant and potentially redevelopable land if that land was owned by an existing firm and either reserved for future expansion or used in industrial storage. I'm surprised that's been challenged in this case. That's pretty standard stuff. And then you go on to priorities, the selection. And so they just basically make the case that the 2 mile limit is supported by studies. It meets the requirements for exceptional priorities. They correctly determined that the class 3 farm soils were beyond that. It was a nice bright line rule. And they didn't have to, you know, have a rule that was less specific than that. That was more site specific than that. In fact, they liked the idea of a bright line rule. Okay, that's that. Any questions about Woodburn? Anybody still awake?
So that's going to be adjudicated when?
That one is going to be, we should have a decision before appeals. Well, at the earliest, I'd say late 2009, more likely sometime 2010. It probably won't have a decision early enough for us to point that. Oral argument is now scheduled for mid-year.
So, yes, the total cost of the agenda each process and for the Woodburn process today.
Greg?
Excuse me, I was taking notes.
Are those private schools your kids are going to? Or public?
Cost. So, I refuse to answer. I think it's somewhere in July. What was the question?
What is the cost of the ADAIR process and the Woodburn process to date?
I don't know the cost of the ADAIR process. I know that Woodburn has spent, and one of the things that Woodburn did that most jurisdictions don't do was they melded the transportation system plan process with the urban growth boundary process. They did them both at once. That is, there's never been done in the state of Oregon that way before. The transportation system plan was something like $300,000 by the time they got done with it. There's an economic opportunities analysis that was led by FRL West. That was probably $65,000 to $75,000. There's a housing needs analysis, there's population projections. My guess is they're about $750 million pointed out through the process in the county because it won the court appeals. A lot of the time that I spent was negotiating with Marion County, and this is a lesson that I think we should think about here. Is when we began the process, Marion County was opposed to the UDB draft UDB that came before them, draft them, because it was too big. The board changed. The main negotiation between city and county occurred because the changed board thought the UDB was too small, and they wanted them to go to another area of town that actually had a better agricultural soils. So I think it's important that county relationship is extremely important to move forward. We've actually got, we can get documentation on the total cost. There's also a Goal 5 study that was done that usually isn't done in, at the same time, but we're kind of lucky to do that as well. There's a whole series of studies over the time period.
And the private sector costs for, you know, not just attorneys and experts, but opportunity costs. I mean, there's a lot of folks have not come to those places that would be because they can't, you know, they're very not tired of coming. So, whereas in Madeira Village, you know, that started in 1997 period, they were, had their site there in 2001. So, another great one. So.
I have a question. One of the later slides it indicated that they excluded, Woodburn excluded existing industrial land inside the city that was owned by an industrial firm that would be held for expansion or for storage.
That's correct. That's
yeah. It was that criteria? I don't remember that criteria being used back in the Northwest in our analysis. So they relied a whole lot on, you know, expansion within the existing city. Growth values for future industrial growth.
We did use that criteria, especially for use for industrial storage. So, for instance, the mill site, the warehouse site, half of that, half, but a portion of that is a sawdust pile. Mm-hmm. In our storage in that case. So that's essential to doing business. So, I don't think we looked at reserved for future expansion because we didn't find. Businesses that were talking about significant
future expansions.
So.
But how would you, I don't mean to belabor this, but how would you query them? How would Equinor build their plans?
Well, sometimes what we do is we'll call the largest employers in town and ask them if they're since it's not required by Goal 9 anymore, that ends up being fairly expensive. So we don't generally do that as much. It takes a lot of time to do that.
Mike, in our case, it was 74 acres of land that was owned and had a building there. And the firm there had vacant land under the same ownership. And I talked to the planning director and I said, I'll bet you, there's some experience, some of that's not really for sale. He says, oh, just call it up. And so we called up each and every one of them, got a statement, and all of them in the record. And that's what DLC found, and the commission also found to be convincing, is that, hey, that isn't available land the coal mine requires. And so it's for expansion of existing industries, not for new targeted industries.
Okay, on the bend, real quick, I see I'm moving down to just a few more minutes. Bend is important for a lot of reasons. One is that it's a good-sized city. It has a lot of property owners involved on all sides of town with different interests. In addition, the city itself has a 500-acre property, or 1,500-acre property, part of which is already in the UGB. The other thing that's important about Bend is that they are actually adopting their findings tonight. They have been in this process for a while, and they are going to be going through this submittal, we hope, exactly 9 to 12 months ahead of us. So it's going to be important to watch them. The comment letters they've been getting back from DLCD, the findings they've been making, everything that's happening over there gives us some clues. It's on a crib sheet. it's very important. And everybody who's over there is studying these other cases and trying to respond to them. So it gives us a chance to learn and maybe avoid some of the mistakes that the BID is making, if it's making mistakes, and it's the ones of their own. So anyway, here's Bend. There's a current comprehensive plan map. This is their series of maps analyzing their soil types and committed lands and whatnot, parcelization around the city. And just to cut the chase here, this is a fairly aggressive expansion. They're adding almost 8,500 gross acres. They've got an identified need for about 5,000 buildable acres. They've got an extra 519, which is about three times the city of Adair's, which is their modest cushion. The whole thing is done as a post-conventional amendment, not periodic review. They are bigger than Adair Village, so they have to submit it in the manner providing periodic review. Their timeline is looks like this. They started in 2004, doing pretty much what we've been doing for the last year. They initiated a legislative PAPA, and three years later, we're going to do that about a year and a half, a little less than that. Too many ways. And in 2008, they had just in the last 3 months, they had joint planning commission decisions, city council deliberations, work sessions that they're adopting tonight. The county commissioners have been in very close coordination. It doesn't look like there are any issues left between the county commissioners, the county, and the city in its final tentative decision, which was actually adopted in mid-December. The council dropped one piece of property and added another piece of property to respond to concerns and interests of the county. They also made some changes in response, last minute changes in response to LCDC. So it is very likely to go to, it will be automatically reviewed by LCDC. A final decision by LCDC, optimistically, mid to late 2009. All of 2010 will be spent doing paperwork in court of appeals. I'm guessing 2011 will be the decision. In this case, if it goes that far. There are many contenders for inclusion. As I said, there are a number of issues that came up. They didn't want to follow the same housing needs mixed model. They use a transition model, which I think makes sense. Basically saying, we're a long way from that split. We're trying to get there. This is what's reasonable. Housing density issues, the city did not like the projected densities. Again, the city says we're being realistic, we're being minimum and maximum. I think that's unreasonable. Efficiency measures on high density development, I really have no way to evaluate that except that there is a long, long list of efficiency measures that they carefully detail. They do show that, like Springfield, they've had a lot of success. They're ahead of the curve on these alternative measures, and therefore, there's not that much else they can do. They can still do enough to accommodate 1,100 more units than they would without those measures. That knocked about 200 acres off their buildable lands need for residential lands, which, you know, it's a lot of acres, but they're adding about acres too. They came up with a pretty darn generous to themselves allocation of lands for those other things like roads and streets and schools. Some of you probably know that the last 30 years, I think this is right, Greg, we've been using 32%. Isn't that basically it? And that covers everything from schools to streets. That's the whole kicker, right. They came up with a 36% figure. I believe the safe harbor figure is 25%. I'm not sure. Is that correct?
It's 25%.
Okay. So DLCD cites a safe harbor. City says, hey, safe harbors are not standards. That is absolutely true. That is a really good answer as long as what you're doing is reasonable. So you know, we'll see. I think the
question, make a follow-up. 70% you said? And so that if you're adding 1,000 acres, 32% of that is going to be consumed by roads, parks, et cetera?
Okay, Greg?
Yeah, well, these things come with that $50 million. And we can assume that the lowest grant would designate the maximum of that 30%. Now, we could institute efficiency measures like narrower streets, smaller lot sizes, different calculations of roads and spaces and so forth. And you might reduce it to 25%. It's hard to get
under that. So there's a boom burst relationship between the size of the house, there's a lot of these mansions out there, that's going to gobble up a lot of space, that ratio is going to go up.
Well, you know, you could institute something like maximum lot sizes, so you only have minimum lot sizes, but no maximum, so you can consider saying you can't have a lot over 7,000 square feet, for example, but somebody can park 2 lots. So it's pretty tough to do that. And the difficulty in having a relationship between the size of the structure and the lot is that it affects cost of what you're doing. So the more demanded, the more restrictive your lot coverage standards are, you have to increase the value to nothing other than that kind of relationship. So it's kind of a fine line. Lockdown is having a question of availability answer, question of maximum efficiency of use, and then question of affordability.
I know myself, I'm always before LUBA and LCDC, you know, just go back. But I think there's some people on the committee who might benefit by having your insight in who these people are, what these letters stand for, what the culture is like, how do you conduct business? Is it a quasi-legal kind of proceeding? Again, I'm just being somewhat facetious, but I think it may be a little 2 minute kind of education, because we're talking about going to Salem for these things.
How does all that kind of work?
Well, who are these people? Again, I mean, I think it's not clear to some of us.
Okay, I would be happy to do that. Just one thing Greg added on this last point here. Greg has been deeply immersed in the band details for quite some time. He says that actually the schools, parks, and institutional are on top of that 36%. So their real allocation is more like 40-something in so they are being very aggressive. And that's certainly probably a big problem.
Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
They have a pretty aggressive community standard there. Yeah,
they do have some good sized parks. Yeah. But that's on top of the 36%. Yeah. I just off the top of my head, I think that's a tough one to defend. If you have the evidence in the record, can make the case. For example, in the Mindo, they actually ended up having to have quite a bit of land for parks because they needed termination. They didn't want to have parks in the floodplain. They gave very good reasons for that. And most of their park land had previously, that they already had planned, had been in the floodplain. And they said, hey, that's not where we want to have our parks. A lot of their park land inventory just kind of evaporated. That needs to be a place where floods can happen. That's what makes sense. So, it depends on the case you make for it. But honestly, the further away you get from the safe harbor, the higher the bar gets for the quality of the evidence that you get in the record to defend that position. That's what I'd say. So, okay, I want to talk a little bit about the department. The Land Use Board of Appeals is lawyers, 3 lawyers appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. They're pros, they're land attorneys, they tend to be introverts. I can't imagine really working on myself. It's, of course, Lee, you do that for a living, but you're in the same place. But it's
pretty nice guys.
Yeah, they're wonderful. They're wonderful people. I would go nuts in there after 3 days. But they just do, they're absolute pros. They get their work done, they do a very good job. The Court of Appeals generally considers their opinions to be better than most of the briefs they get from the rest of his land use lawyers. I think they're right. They just do a really, really good job, and they turn things around in a hurry. I had a litigation over Eugene's land use code update several years ago. Incredibly complex, detailed. They got back an 85-page opinion on time, about 2.5 months, right down the line. That's how they. 3 months now, the LCDC is really two things. There's the there's a commission, which is appointed volunteers, like John Van Landingham is one, for example, not a professional planner, not paid, more like a city councilor, more like a planning commission. It's really the same kind of thing at the state level. They have a competent staff, and it's a fairly good-sized staff. There's 80 or 90, I think, people in the department. And they do the heavy lifting. They have a pretty strong role in the statutes and the rules, decision-making roles, on more of a policy level a lot of times than, I'd say, planning staff does at the local level. They're very mission-oriented, let's put it that way. When you go to the, when something goes up to DLCD, they get a record which has to have there are a lot of requirements for what we submit to them in terms of detail of whatnot. The staff writes a very professional, long, detailed report. That is then sometimes goes to the staff report of the commission. Sometimes there's an appeal from that to the commission. The commission generally holds a hearing if there's an appeal, and it's one of those things where the mayor and the planning director and city attorney all kind of show up and have very little time to say much of anything, and then they all dither for about 4 hours and make a decision, which is totally unpredictable.
That's part I remember.
Does that sound about right, Ken?
Yeah.
So usually the local government gets hung.
That's my 2-minute version. Yeah, but as I say, you know, in case of Woodburn, they went with Woodburn. In case of Brookings, they went with Brookings. Sometimes they go the other way. You just never know. But a good compare and contrast is Corvallis, where our office had a similar appeal of a similar code set of issues that went to the commission and DLCD instead of going to LUBA. They never even got, I mean, now they just, oh, city's okay. You know, it was just, they just didn't do it. So those are the differences. Both cases, it goes to the Court of Appeals, which is a very, very, very common court. And it sits in panels of three. There's 11 judges. It's in panels of three. Okay. But they're not fixed. Okay, last thing I want to do is to kind of point out a couple of things. There are some choices that can be made about how to go about long-range planning. And one is kind of go for everything now. The other is to be very conservative and do just what you think you can, you know, ensure you can get away with. The problem with the going for everything is you get hung up and you don't get everything, and what you do get, you don't get until you're looking at 10 years instead of 20 years. If you go for too little, you can end up with some findings that all I need for 20 whole years is X, when what you actually need for 20 whole years is X plus Y, okay? But some jurisdictions have taken the position that we're going to be conservative, and what you need to know, and it's written right in our plan, Florence did this with its industrial plans, LCDC actually asked Ben to do some of this, Ben Klein, to say, well, look, you know, some of this stuff's a little speculative side. We know you can come back in 5 years and push it out another 5 years. We can get this issue in periodic review. We can, you know, there are other opportunities to come back and do this. There's a political decision to be made by the city councils of these two jurisdictions and the boards of county commissioners about this HB 337 process. We do want a good 20 year supply of land, and we do want to get through this process in a reasonable amount of time. So, those are some of the trade-offs. There are strategies for taking a middle road that doesn't necessarily lock you in one way or the other. kind of the old Aristotelian cliche, moderation of all things. No guarantee, but generally. So I did have lots more stuff, but I don't have lots more time. I would like to look at the pictures as much as you guys want.
Any questions about?
Very good. And there are the handouts. There are a few typos, but the detail will be.
Thank you. Okay.
I was kind of suggesting maybe we take a 5 minute break.
1:40. Why don't we get back to the 20 after? 25 after.
Said, we're not going to hold out UGB stuff as long as you have done the kind of thing that they did in the, you know, the master plan and say, there's a lot of people.
Is that just another
question? Brookings has a transportation. Brookings has a transportation system. Yeah, right. Nobody has the money to handle. Right. I mean, basically, all the planning is there now. Particular landowners don't have resources. The one landowner who does have the resources, Rio Tinto, which is by our
Yes, and steep slopes. But then you go on to, here's area number one. And this black line, it's the same black line that you see there.
Yep.
I think that's the 1 mile mark. Although that might be the half mile mark.
second. That's going to be from this screen to where over here.
Yes.
Or should I be here talking to you over there?
Yeah, I can be Dana for you. And then we've also got that map.
Okay, so we're just going to go around and we're just going to do a brief overview of some of the topics and put together all the strengths. What we'd like to do is go to 0 and 9 acres. We'll look at all 10.
10.
Where's the 10?
It's right here.
Oh, 10 is the 10. I don't think it's
10.
And they've had copies. They've received copies of all 29 maps. One thing I was going to mention, I think the important thing to remind the committee is that the next, well, this meeting and then the next 2 meetings, they're going to continue this conversation and wrap it up.
Why don't you introduce it that way?
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, you're going to start it off with that?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, this is where I'm going to do this. Here's what we've found so far.
Uh-huh.
This is the beginning.
Yeah.
What have we missed?
Yeah.
We've got something wrong.
Guys out there. And we're meeting also, we're meeting with this PAC this Friday, the technical president, to add in more infrastructure. But that's, I mean, because that's more of a technical side.
Right.
I think it's a good piece of information. But we want to see what I want to reinforce with this is for the first time in the beginning of exciting stuff on the ground. And that is critical. It's critical that we're consistent in our approach throughout.
And
we are so far out.
And
you will fill me in.
Some of these areas may not be suitable for industrial and commercial, and they may be more suitable for residential.
We'll begin that next month, and then
yeah,
that's
not talking about that. This one's an idea. All right, so, all right, Greg, now you're last.
Yeah, that's all I have to say.
To the real beat of where we're going, and I think, and staff's going to correct me if I say this wrong, we're sort of doing the jump now. We've been spending most of our meetings before talking about an analysis of the need and the demand. We pretty much, at least for ourselves, have defined that, and I believe the council is going to make a decision on that next week, or I think that's what we're scheduled to do. The next piece, then, that we're going to shift to is, given that demand, it's we're going to expand the UGB and look for things. Where do we look and what are the concerns? So I think what the staff is going to do with this now is they've looked at the alternative areas around, and I believe what they want out of us tonight is preliminarily, and I think we have a couple more meetings to go on this one, is they're going to give us a preliminary discussion of what the technical advisory committee and staff has looked at, and they want from us is our initial reactions to that, as well as any questions we have, things that we would like them to look at some more, if we need more information in order to make a recommendation. So I think that's where we're at. David, did I cover it?
That sounds really good. Just to sum that up again, like Lee said, this conversation will carry over into the next two meetings we have. Remember, we're scheduled January 22nd, and then February 26th is our last scheduled stakeholder meeting. So this meeting and the next two will be talking about this, about the expansion areas, and so at some point in this, in the next few meetings here, we'll also be incorporating the residential component of this, which at this point you all haven't seen, but that will be coming before you as well.
So could you mention those next two meeting dates you need to?
Yeah, January 22nd and then February 26th. Those are both the fourth Thursday. And then this Friday, just to let you know as well, this Friday, January 9th, we will be having our last technical advisory committee meeting, and so that will help us fill in some of these blanks in terms of infrastructure needs going on. So, and with that, that's all I have.
So I'll take it from here. What we're really doing now is taking the site requirements that we've all been developing in the last 6 months or so, and looking at those and applying them on the ground to 10 potential expansion areas. And you heard Al talk about the importance of clearly defining what those site criteria are and applying them systematically on the ground, so you're not applying them one way in one place, another way in another. That is really critical to our success. One thing that we are doing here that Ben didn't do was just that. Ben pretty much said, here's where we'd like our UGB to be. Now let's make the findings fit that decision. We're building it from the ground up. I think we're taking a moderate approach, as Al was talking about. I think that's the way to go. In the 10 areas that we have, staff and the consultants and TAC have all come up with their preliminary view, that's just preliminary, of the qualities of each of those areas. And I think the key purpose is to get from you, did we miss things? Did we get some things wrong? And if you have anything specific, specific information about why a site makes sense or doesn't, that's really important, because I can tell you from years of doing this, GIS mapping is a useful tool. It's also a dangerous tool, because you end up believing your own maps. And the maps often are only as good as the input that goes into them. If you have people who know the ground, who walk the ground, and can objectively state what's there, that is evidence in the record. It was the type of evidence we did use in Woodburn. Just saying, some of this land looks great on paper. The tax assessments map say it's available. Let's look more closely and make sure it actually is. So the first area that we've got on the screen is area number one, I-5 North, North Gateway. It's an area that I'm very familiar with. I think all of you are. So what you see as you come down I-5. And it was given a high rating in many regards for being a prime industrial site. What I'd like to do at this point is turn it over to Beth and have her read what we've found out so far about this area.
Okay. So you've all got this memo that Dave sent out that contains a table that shows the employment areas, public service opportunities and constraints in one table, and then the other one that shows employment areas, opportunities, employment opportunity areas, site characteristics and suitability. So what we've got up here on all these papers are basically an amalgamation, just a combination of what's in those two tables. So your comments tonight will be added to those tables, augment them. So looking at the constraints on the North Gateway area, for wastewater, they may require another wastewater pumping station, and getting wastewater service to North Gateway may cost more than other areas. There's no stormwater system of the North Gateway. There's a lot of wetlands, riparian areas, and natural resources, as you can see on this map here, and in one of the 29 maps that Dave sent you. In terms of transportation, there's no internal road network. And then another comment is that portions of the site are on the floodplain and the floodway. So then my question for you, our question for you is, what are the constraints do you know for the North Gateway area? What other things should we add as constraints
Do we know how big that area is that's not within the floodplain and floodway?
I don't. I believe that Bob does. So I can't answer that question for you, but we can get back to you about that later.
I may need to do a condition that each photograph's got the acreage attached to it.
Is the bottom piece there? Is that a shoulder?
Well, Lee, one other question from JT over there who might be able to answer this. Didn't the Sacred Heart do an updated review of the floodplain and that drastically changed the Army Corps' assessment of what's in a floodplain and what's not?
I don't know if I can say it drastically changed.
What changed?
What the Army Corps found was acceptable, but you see the crescent-shaped piece at the bottom there, that large one, just about, yeah, that's the Wickland property. The line that was done, that was actually adjusted by the consultants, Dave Evans Associates, went about halfway through that property and stopped. So what's happening north of that, we're not sure. That is, the study didn't go that any further north than that. That parcel is about 100 acres, and the parcel to the left of it and just northwest of it is about 60 acres. So that's about 160 acres. So maybe your question is, it's probably somewhere between 400 and 500 acres total.
I remember 400 acres in the past that actually was some of the flood plain actually went to the
yes, it was almost always side of the freeway. Correct. Yeah. Well, there's a low spot underneath the freeway that the water can cross near Johnson Road, which is the overpass, and also right next to that little clump of trees on the bottom next to the E-Web flexible site.
So you think there's 400 acres in
there? It might be 400 acres. Yeah, be close to that. On the side of the freeway, south of the river.
Looking at my colors.
So,
I would think that one of the things, to the extent we can find it out easily, is really to ascertain how much of that is available for development.
Beth, maybe you could go put your finger on the constraints map there so people can see that's all blue.
There's a lot of it. It is in the floodplain.
The dark blue is floodway.
That's the old floodway. And the way we look at it now, even though there's two definitions of what the floodway is, we take the more restrictive of them. In this case, it would include a good portion of Whitman property, even though the more recent study showed that that may be out of the floodway.
So,
just a couple of observations. You know, none of the floodway or flood plain was changed, okay? So the study was done for purposes of the PSOL project, but we didn't change the maps or go through a letter of map revision or map amendment or anything like that. So the maps are what they are for those properties until unless they change them. The question I have, though, is for the riparian resource area, which is overlay on the GIS map shows a big teal area, and the Wickland property is a pretty clear bladed area, so I'm wondering how that kind of got a flag. It's been formed for about 100 years, kind of 8 years. So I don't know if anybody knows kind of what that layer is supposed to represent. So there may be, I don't know, the Wickland property is going to reflect planes, but I don't know if it's undevelopable or.
Yeah, do you know what these are carrying now?
I don't know offhand how we use that for the definition.
What David was saying was the local wetland inventory was prepared, and those are typically prepared for the land inside. And so you wouldn't expect to have riparian areas outside you to be mapped.
Okay. You may know. Yeah, Mark Metzger back here. So going back to the late 1980s and early 1990s, the Plain Council governments, in conjunction with the various communities, developed sort of a first pass draft of natural resource sites. And it included areas outside Springfield UGB because Lane County was a partner in that mapping.
Okay.
And so
that was part of, I think it was identified as site S17 as a riparian area. It doesn't mean the entire area was covered with trees, but for whatever reason it was included in that inventory. I don't know why it was included at that time, but I could recognize the crescent shape as being part of that early inventory.
So it wasn't technical local wetlands inventory, but it was preliminary estimate.
The riparian was more of, gee, we like this piece, we're going to call it a riparian resource.
Well, it was, these were, well, I think, George is going to take issue with that. Well, no, I mean, I think it's more, these were identified as goal five resource lands,
yeah,
high priority. So the issue here would be the extra hurdle that you'd have to jump because it's not just ag land, but it's also been identified as a goal five resource.
This is actually an important question. Is it part of an adopted inventory?
Yes.
I'm getting
now. It was the natural resource study, and where Kent's left.
Okay. I don't think we've been arguing, but we need to find out.
We don't need to determine that.
It was just inside
just flagging an issue. My concern is when we did the original industrial lands and stuff, the original metro plan, we didn't know anything about wetlands or any of that stuff, and a lot of the land that we originally put in there, we subsequently found out was not usable because of these things, things that came up. My point is that we got to be careful as we're doing the alternatives analysis to the extent that with the professional staff we can find, so we have a good look and say that if we include this land in there, is it going to be able to be developed? And I don't think we need to answer that tonight. We're just raising the issues. Dan?
We got a lot of others to consider. The one that's interesting to me is under transportation for North Gateway. Underpass, overpass, that's Johnson Road, right? I think it's really important, provides potential access. That's, it would be huge to have two-way access there. But can you tell me, this is from the technical group, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what discussion happened for them to say there's potential access from that current overpass?
I don't think it's access to I-5, it's access to roads.
Speed of Mike Keller.
We talked about access to I-5.
One of the Mike Kelly's parked
double flyer. Access from the road to that side.
From the overpass.
There's no access to I-5, and it's too close, and the standard separation between the interchanges.
Even at the northern end of that?
2 miles separation. We have several that are much closer than that. This would fall way within 2 mile range.
So, I think what you said about constraints is that the concern is how much of this land is buildable. So, it's not a constraint.
By your map 3, none of it is
buildable. Well, land that is in the floodplain is not necessarily buildable. Land that's in the floodway.
Well, I don't know, you know, how much emphasis to put on words and stuff. I mean, I like the site for a number of reasons. You know, for industrial, commercial, it's popular, it's visible, but I also have a real concern on transportation and that interchange there, the intersection. I mean, it has very limited, as far as ODOT's concerned,
right,
has very limited capacity. So I don't know when we say, you know, may have interchange access difficulties, if that truly captures it. We're talking about significant difficulties there to get a lot of capacity at that interchange to serve hundreds of acres to the north. So,
if I can add to that, one thing I heard from ODOT last time I spoke with somebody over there was in regards to that, there could be potential limitations in terms of density or build outs, in terms of trip caps. Or how many vehicle trips can be accommodated with new development there. So that's, I guess, that would be something to list under potential constraint.
So what about opportunities?
Well, I like the idea that it's a large portion. I guess that's a key question now, 400 500 acres and just how contiguous are the usable acres, but looking at a site that might accommodate projects that are 25, 50 acres, they're going to be hard to come by, and I guess I would suggest that transportation is going to play into each and every one of those kinds of things. And the aggregate, I mean, if you just say this will be developed in the next 20 years, that's our horizon, you have to, even if it's the most passive thing on there, it's going to add to some capacity. When you don't know what's going to be there, there's still going to be a capacity figure that somebody comes up with and says, for the meantime, we're going to figure this way. And I think that's a really important question to answer. And it's not just that area. When I look at, there's the question of transportation capacity adjoining it or access to it. But I do like it because it does have potentially some of the larger sites. And
the other positive on it is that it's roughly adjacent to a large developed employment center. It's very visible from I-5 and be an attractive site. And probably in terms of transportation, because we're running the express bus thing out there, and it lends itself well to reducing BMT. Vehicle miles traveled.
I'd just like to make some general comments about the floodplain here. It's as complicated as the LUMA process, but I think it really needs some context, because it's very tempting to look at these large vacant parcels as a possible solution. But in fact, from my experience, we need to understand what happens in the floodplain. Peace Health did their analysis to look at, there's a technical term for floodway and there's the floodplain. The floodplain is where the river actually occupies during a 100-year flood. The floodway is the statistical approximation of how constricted the river can get to carry a 100-year flood and have the waters of a 100-year flood rise 1 foot from the base elevation. So it's first of all, it's statistical. It also means that it assumes you're going to build completely in the floodplain, and that's going to raise the floodwater level up a foot. Well, whether it's an inch or a foot, if it's your house and it's wet, it's still wet. It doesn't matter whether there's a foot of water in it or an inch of water. If it's adjacent farmland, you've got other problems. But from a community perspective, I think we need to look at what happens on the cumulative impact here. If we build up the floodplain downstream from our brand new hospital, where is that floodwater going to go? I mean, that's what you have a floodplain for. The floodwater has to go someplace, and what it's going to do is it's either going to go on the other side of the river, it's going to back up someplace, it's going to create a problem on an adjacent property. And so I think when we look at developing in the floodplain, even though it's tempting to look at these as isolated sites, I think we really need to keep the perspective that it's going to take a problem and move it someplace else. And where is that going to be? There's no free lunch here.
Across the freeway.
We got nine others to go.
I was going to say, we've got nine other sites. Do we need to say anything else about North Gateway?
Any more on this? Move on.
We'll have more opportunities to talk about it. So, site number two is the Hayden Bridge area.
We'll picture of that as well.
And that is this area. We went the wrong way. Two more.
Oh, I see. There you
go. So this is the Hazel Bridge area. If you didn't know.
Hazel Bridge.
So
David,
someone,
can you orient us on the slide there?
I'm sorry, you said.
Can you orient us on that slide?
Okay.
So Wizard Bridge.
But you go back to the.
Put your finger up in the air. That's it.
That's right.
There you go.
Yeah.
So the area of Mohawk Valley?
Yeah, that's the road that goes up through there.
Yeah.
And then the existing UGB is the, is that the purple
red line?
Okay. The red line.
So you're looking across.
So everybody's clear where we're at?
Eden Bridge Road would be the road that goes.
So it's right here on the big map. So some of the opportunities are that it's got transportation access from Marcola Road, and that there's an existing bridge in place. Some of the constraints are that it may require a wastewater pumping station across the river. It may cost more than other areas, but there's potential for gravity flow in some areas. You'd have to develop a stormwater system, and some of the site in some area is in the floodplain or floodway or on steep slopes. Yes?
I hope I'm thinking of the same place. You cross the river, you've got an all stop sign there, and then there's Old Mohawk to the left, Mohawk, and then Camp Creek is a store there, right?
That's across the bridge.
Across the bridge. Right. It really, I don't know, I could be totally wrong here, but it seems really confining, just the geography of the area. Now, I see you note that there's some steep slopes on the east side of Marcola Road, but we're talking about development on alongside either side of Marcola Road, correct? Or in between Old Mohawk and Marcola Road?
I'm thinking the only way you're going to get development in there is between Marcola Road and Old Marcola Road and Hill back in there. Because I think everything's, guys, everything to the west, different directions from the Old Marcola Road is probably in the floodplain, isn't it?
Hey, Greg, can you go forward some slides?
It's floodplains, I bet.
There you go.
It's back there.
That's where we were.
Oh, sorry.
Keep going.
Another one.
There
you go. And so the blue. Is that
so that's Mohawk. It's close to
between the two roads.
So keep in mind that some of these sites may or may not be good for employment. So it may well be that if we're looking at some of these sites, that, again, they may be more appropriate for residential.
Actually, that belly area, there are some really nice sites in there, but it's, my concern is that the hydro schools.
Wetlands.
Yeah, we're looking at wetlands when we get down there, sort of like you have the two hills, and all of a sudden, the water's got to run someplace.
Aren't there, don't you have hydro soils on one of these maps?
Not on any of these that are
on
the top here.
And we don't have that in this slide series, though, Beth?
No.
They were in your packet, of the 29 maps. That was
the two-hour download, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes.
Beth, I would say the real concerns here, looking at it, and from the industrial side, I think that residential, there's some potential there. You can work around them, but from the industrial commercial side, well, I think it may be industrial, is whether there's, given the hydric soils and stuff, whether it's developable. I would say that one of the positives of it is that relatively easy to service with infrastructure, because almost all of it's right at the bridge now, and you have pretty good access to I-105. 42nd Street, so it's a very attractive site.
Does someone know which is the old Weyerhaeuser Fish Farm that E-Web owns now, the aquaculture one?
Is that the green?
The tip of the blue is where it is.
The tip of the blue,
right?
It's right down to the bridge.
So well,
the one other question that I have is in the notes again. I guess from the group surrounding uses are compatible with office, retail, and other services, but I can't for the life of me. I know that it's situated where you're not too far from 42nd Street or I-15 and things, but the surrounding uses, it doesn't strike me as many times that I've gone out there that there are those surrounding. What was the thinking of the technical group on that comment?
The thinking was that while the surrounding uses aren't compatible with industrial, certainly, and that small-scale office or retail.
So it's suitable as a site, but it's not surrounded with light things because it really there is none of that out there. You know, there's the store, and beyond that is the golf course, and not a heck of a lot.
Yeah, but it could be. I mean,
I just said it's compatible. I just don't. If you're doing retail out there and you had a real, a shoe store out there, there's no residential area right now. I don't know where your clients. If it's a very specialized office kind of thing or a campus-like thing, I can see a campus set.
Rich Brooks.
Pardon?
Rich Brooks. It's less than a mile from the new
42nd.
The Home Depot thing, right?
Yep. Dan, we were taking the long look at that.
You mean so Marcolo Meadows?
Yeah. Lowe's. Lowe's. Yeah.
Lowe's.
If there was more development there, then there might be
I think the residential site, if you can envision that hill, at one point, and I don't know if it would have been subdivided, but I remember in the early 60s, there was an envision for a fairly large residential in Rainbow Water.
It's in a 20-acre site screen. That 10 to 20-acre site then is because of the thinness of the soil and the size of the lot.
So, unless you guys have other comments, going to site number three. So site number three is the North Springfield Highway area. It's in this area above this little protrusion. It's relatively it's right along Highway I-105. So there's potential access to 105 and Hyvex Road. David, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe ODOT said that they're in the process of planning some improvements to that. On 105, I thought. To the intersections up there?
Yeah, that portion is 126.
Yeah,
okay. This is 126 Express.
Yeah.
We're talking about both sides of the river now? For Site 3?
Site 3.
No.
The purple line would be the edge of the...
We may be talking both sides.
That's the roof.
Oh, I see. There's the black.
There's a buffer.
Here's the UGB. Here's the metro plan designation. And then above that, the other side of the river.
Just wondering, they, since the...
Again, it's a floodway issue?
Yes.
I remember when we grew the UGB... At that time, we grew up right along the floodway.
Yeah,
but that's changed a few times.
Well, yeah, I've got it. Before I say anything, declare a potential conflict of interest here because my property is within this area here. But I would like to keep my comments factual, and I don't think it's going to present a problem. I see there are, at least in that brown area there that has just got that odd shape on the east side. The flood maps are I don't know where you got the flood maps, but that does not correspond to the where the actual floodwaters are. If you go back to the aerial photograph, on the right side of the map there where the urban growth boundary does its first jog there. Yeah, no, keep going to your right, David. Keep going to your right, keep going to your right. And then right there, that's Springfield Middle School right there. Yeah, and the floodwaters in 1996, which were a 40-year event, covered two-thirds of the Springfield Middle School property, so I don't know again what you're talking about, but that area there is clearly in a floodplain. There's two other constraints here that I think we need to account for. One is, I realized that when we were talking about potential constraints, we'd never looked at the subs groundwater protection zone, which is an overlay zone for the city. And if we're talking about commercial development, there are some absolute constraints that would prohibit any commercial development from areas that are close enough to sub well fields. And sub has, in that brown area, concentration of well fields, that brown area in the lower right. The other constraint, which is not mentioned here in the stormwater, is that Cedar Creek is receiving area for all of the city stormwater in that area, and it flows through that area. And according to studies that the city performed, Cedar Creek is pretty close to its carrying capacity for build out within the existing urban growth boundary for stormwater discharge.
Great spot. You got that creek there full all season. I have a hard time with that too, because the sub well fields are, there's no indication they will be, I mean, they can't move in. I know when we were looking at the Oregon Rivers Museum, they were saying that that was a potential site, but the board at that time said it was too close for any major development that included parking, asphalt, that kind of thing. And the time of travel, I mean, you're right on top of the well field, so.
And again, is this area occupied part of the area east of the Mohawk and north of the river? Or is marginal lands areas in purple? Or is that part of site two?
No, this is, if you're going across along Camp Creek Road, Bellinger Boat Landing is where the river does its, if you're coming from the east, it does its little dip in there.
I mean, I know what we're talking about. I'm just trying to say, is site two part of, does it include, is site two north of the river, site three is south of the river? Is that the way we're distinguishing these?
Site two is also.
So site two has south of the river.
Right here, versus
right here. Well, I'm just wondering which site includes this big area of pink marginal land.
That's site two.
Yeah.
That's more like that.
Yeah.
I have real concerns about this. I like George, I've seen the flat water there a couple of times. All over the Blue Water Boat used to be ocean, and I've been flooding through there. And at least half of that orchard I've seen underwater.
Yeah.
About 3 feet of water. I'm real skeptical about that as a building site.
Lively swim park, which I think you can pick up. It's just a skinny lot next to the school there. They launched jet boats in 1996 from the parking lot and away to rescue people off of 66th Street. So I encourage staff to take a look at the flood maps in there.
I believe the Corps of Engineers.
They can study it. I seen it in 96 and I seen it in 96
in
the water.
I know that people that apply for annexations in the sound. You guys have
more
any
on this one?
Comments about
folks?
Number three?
Move on.
Okay, so area number four is far east Springfield. I'm very excited. So
is this considered part of the Cedar Flats area?
Yeah.
Where is the UGB? What is this boundary on? Is that Thurston Road by chance? It comes into 126, or is it further out or closer?
So right here is the urban growth boundary.
Yeah, on the aerial photograph, it might be helpful if someone were to show where Thurston Road runs into Main Street or Highway 126. I think
It's where that you can see it curves around and then dumps. Keep going there.
Right, whoop.
No,
right there.
Right there. That's where Thurston Road.
Yeah, where it comes down.
Correct.
So where is the site that we're looking at?
Where we are looking
outside.
The everything is
straight to the east.
Outside. See the red? Okay, yeah, the red is the urban growth boundary, which looks like it overlaps the purple. And then can you switch it to another map? It might be easier.
So the black line is the everything.
Oh, no,
that's the metro boundary.
There, yeah. This is
the purple's metro.
This is
that's UGB right there.
UGB right there.
So that black line that's bent and it goes through the up and down is is that a half mile out?
So 1 mile.
1 mile.
Okay. So we're looking at 1 mile and plus.
Extending that the addition would be moving that 1 mile.
Moving it out some amount.
So this is existing urban growth boundary. This purple line is the metro area boundary. Yeah. And then the black line is the 1 mile, let's go 1 mile out for the existing.
I thought maybe this got changed, but when the metro plan was originally done, some of the property that's inside the metro plan boundary, but east of the UGB was classified as an urban reserve. And did that go away somehow? Because
yeah,
actually
did.
Okay. Okay, so that.
That was one of the areas originally we talked about.
Are there any wells out there that dovetail with George's DWP issue?
I think, no, the sub does not have any wells at that far.
However, I do have a map of the wellhead protection area that does include a portion of that area that you mentioned earlier, George, of the wellhead. So they've got an area that's been defined with
time of travel.
Protection areas around it. So we can overlay that and see where and what sure. might develop in those areas. Yeah, that'd be fine.
So
David, is a consideration from the perspective for residential or for industrial commercial?
Well, we were thinking about this one is probably more appropriate for residential. Okay. But we,
what says it's compatible with office, retail, and other services, and I think that makes more sense than the other slopes aren't too bad. Probably break some universal record for the longest Main Street ever.
The soils on the south side of the street are too less good quality, people like class 4 soil, sometimes kind of stuff. This used to be built on the south side of the wind, be good at the elements of the students and the trees.
Just one potential constraint again is the stormwater and how to handle that, because again the receiving body of water would, unless there's something new developed, would be Cedar Creek. And for the gray, what was that called, Mike, the gray subdivision, was that what it's called?
Yes.
Which is inside the UGB, just to the in that white area there, that was one of the major constraints for a build out on that, was what to do with the stormwater, because they had to do a lot of on-site retention in order to meet the restriction or the constraints at Cedar Creek. So again, stormwater might be a problematic issue here.
But wouldn't that be the same issue then? Pretty much any development that might occur, whether in the UGB and in the city limits now or elsewhere, the drains into Cedar Creek is going to have to essentially treat all its stormwater on site and, otherwise deal with a capacity issue on a regional basis.
Yeah, I mean, the city has done some long-term engineering studies that would have collected the stormwater and done something else with it. But, I mean, that's a huge infrastructure issue.
There's also some pretty steep slopes, and now we're doing the grain property. The amount of development you're doing is pretty limited because of the slopes and the water. Unless convince somebody to build a tower really high up. There's going to be water to it.
So you're on the comments. Why the UGB is where it is? You starting to understand why the
So when you look at this map, the constraints map, all the dark red is 25%. Which is what we need. It's quite a bit.
Dark red what?
So, shall we go on to area number 5?
Let's do that.
All right, in area number 5, areas number 5 and 6 are right next to each other, and they're shown together here on this map. There's half of the Jasper Natron area. So area number 5, area number 5 ends up being over in that area, and area number 6 is ending up over in that area. From right here, I can't tell you if it's which side of the
so river. So one's on one side of the river and one's on the other, is that how these are?
Yes. Yes, they're divided by the river. So starting with area 5, which is labeled the Wallace Creek Road area.
So Wallace Creek Road is the road that goes up to the northeast there from the more or less the central part of the map, is that correct?
Just out of Jasper.
Right, so Jasper is just below that. And that's so the Jasper Bridge.
So why do both of those areas say they're compatible with industrial? Why do they say that the surrounding uses are compatible with industrial, but they're shown as not being suitable for warehousing and distribution?
Because they're pretty far from highway road.
Okay.
They don't have good...
And that's the same basis for saying they're not suitable for retail?
Retail is distance from existing residential, and you don't really want to put large town retail out on the when you do, it creates some problems. And so the Jasper Natron area has some areas that are currently designated for industrial use.
Yeah, not only access to Jasper Road, but you know the connection that goes all the way down to Jasper Road from the really called extension 58. So you do have pretty good access to this area once you get on Jasper. You either go northwest, or you go north, you go to Main Street at 126.
So maybe that's something we could look again at.
I don't see constraints here. This is along the Willamette River, and so there's a Willamette Greenway issue that hasn't been come to the surface in any of the previous places that we've looked at. I know that's particularly true for number 6. I farm that property right in there, which does flood quite actively, and the area that is out of the flood plain, that's north of that flood plain area though, is that's all Greenway property in there, right in there. Yeah. So access to that is
Parkway comes out.
Right, but that's on the south side or the
right.
Whatever side of the river.
South side of the river.
Yeah.
It comes on the west side of the river, which?
The, I don't know. Yeah, the west.
What about the part that already abuts the Jasper Natron area and is already zoned? I'm talking about the Wallace Creek Road area.
This is the top of the ridge.
Right.
Zone residential, and this slopes towards this with Walls Creek Road here. So it's fairly gentle slopes. It was treed at one time, but it's all cleared. Except the top part of this ridge along the railroad.
So the access would be from Walls Creek Road then?
Walls Creek Road, you've got the warehouse of Hall Road there.
Right.
Up through here. That's one potential access point. Armstrong Parkway, in a road that goes to the Brandes Road, which is across.
How many acres, John, do you think would be in just the Wallace Creek Road part there?
How much area?
Yeah, how many acres? 200?
Maybe 350 to 400 on tops. Because I think this is part of the warehouse of Hall Road. This is steep slope from here.
Would you be unable to span, not remembering from memory, what that bridge is like over there? You weren't able to get from one end to the other by some internal roadways?
You could do it from the internal roadway, but the best one would be the warehouse of Hall Road. This stuff would all be local two-lane, local access road. That's fairly steep hill, very large lots. So this looked at being a large lot because of it's like 2 feet of soil or 3 feet of soil on top of a volcanic intrusion that's up there. And then there's a big precipice along here that's very nice, interesting rock outcropping. Originally, we hoped to extend the Bob Straub Parkway this way and then use this to jump over the river off the top of the hill rather than build the bridge all the way around.
Did the technical team, you can see, well, maybe it's not, but Jasper has some industrial land. There's a mill just south of town. Did anyone, I know you've tried to keep this within a 1 mile thing, but did anyone look at what's there?
So you're asking me further south, if we identified that? We hadn't been looking at that specifically now.
Well, the thing that seems to be driving our discussion is commercial land, industrial land. And there's a fairly large industrial site just on the edge of town there, on the edge of Jasper. I don't know, does it show up in one of these?
That big mill out underneath the railroad trestle and on the left?
No, this is before it.
Closer to Jasper.
Oh, it's got, maybe.
So both areas 5 and 6 are rated as suitable for industrial.
It might be where that big white patch is. Is that a log pond? I think it might be that big sea pond. Right there.
So it's a wood products mill.
It's a wood products mill. They had a big fire there a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. It's not all American stud. I forget. Who operates that.
Does this include, and I guess I'm thinking residential, the slopes up from Jasper Natron going up, there's kind of a little valley going up that area, one of those hills? And that seemed like it'd make a logical extension from Jasper Natron.
From Jasper Natron, if you look at over there on that map, those are the steep slopes that go up above it. And basically, a bunch of this is.
That's Mountain Gate.
That's Mountain Gate.
Mountain Gate is up there. There's a little slope up in this area, but most of this is pretty steep stuff right here. And then it just comes over the top of we're talking about this area right
now. Yeah, it's looking steeper than the stuff.
But it's got a big
piece of Main Street going up.
Well, if you're on the warehouse of Hall Road, it's up pretty steep this way. It's this way, not just a little slope.
Okay.
When you get to the south. And then it gets gradually again once you cross this small creek, and then it gets steep again on the east side right up here.
So did you guys have any other comments about Wallace Creek? Do you have any separate comments about Point 6, the Jasper Bridge area? Were those the same comments that you had on?
Mr. Jasper?
Well, I made some comments specific to Area 6 in terms of that flooding along the Aggieland and the Willamette Greenway, but you may have captured those, yeah.
Well, what's down here? That graded area looks wet to me, too. Not just wet, wet.
Also, I think it's probably, you know, George and I talked, but Wallace and Mass felt that way. I don't think.
Yeah, it's AC.
Yeah, if we go forward with these, it might be good to
spell it.
Yeah. It's AC. Spell it.
So let's go on to area number 7, which we refer to as the Clearwater area, down south of the town.
What's the colors?
Well, there's mahogany lane on there.
It's underwater.
We're underwater. It's a
party. ECU, exclusive commercial.
So one opportunity that we didn't get up here that as the list is that the school district owns the land that's outside of the UGB. Right down on I'm not exactly sure on this map where it is. Was it about a 50-acre parcel?
Well, it should show up as green on the one. Didn't you have green as your public lands?
It's on the blue one.
Oh, yeah. No. I guess I'm wrong about that. Yeah, that's the
we've got exactly where the land is on the map. It's land that they've purchased looking at the building on in the future.
So Clearwater Lane is, can someone highlight that? Oh, I needed the photograph. It's all
that's
okay.
It.
All right. And so the park is where?
Right at the end.
Right here? Okay.
Yeah. Good place to hang out.
And we're looking at this area as having some potential for residential development, possibly, and a little less for the industrial.
The issue there again is going to be flood.
Yeah.
But there is rail. Is there rail access in this?
No.
Okay.
I think the comment on this one, I don't believe that this is suitable for commercial industrial. It's pretty much residential.
I agree with that.
I guess I would say yes. From all the places we've looked at, it seemed like there could be some commercial because it is in a neighborhood. In a way.
Neighborhood commercial.
Yeah, neighborhood commercial, but not a large, large project, unless we thought that the residential area was going to go away in between. One thing that would be really useful for if we're going to be looking at these next two meetings is to get a handle. What's the acreage we're looking at? 100, 200 acres?
It's about 400, 500.
The question is how much of it is usable.
Yeah, it's hard for me to see.
I think it'd be possible to come back. Here's a total acreage of the area. Here's how much is usable using these measures.
It'd be quite useful.
Yeah, the one constraint I would like to add again is just in terms of impacts on the floodplain. If you don't build around those channels and leave them open, you're going to create problems. And so that natural flood channel needs to be respected to a certain extent. That's the light blue area that just naturally fills up with water there, or it's going to create problems. So you might want to look at that as a constraint.
We also have some storm drainage that comes across from Jasper Natron and just misses this little house on Mahogany Lane.
Takes a little jog there, doesn't it?
I think there's a big concrete thing called a slump at that Jasper Saloon or something.
The worst sub's water treatment facility on
that's further.
Yeah, right about where the legend is.
So again, that's something that may end up seeing as a, you look at that as the same way as you look at the impacts on the groundwater as, you know, anything that could get into that could create an issue.
Another element for the floodplain areas is for residential especially, they've changed the loan possibilities for those and the rules for getting loans in those areas. And I don't know if that applies to industrial or commercial, but loans and insurance floodplains might have changed where it wouldn't be appealing to somebody. That's something we're addressing with maps.
And we do have the greenway issue there too. More on this one?
Let's go on to area number 8. And that is further to the west, area 7, here, Milrose. South of Milrose area.
So most of it is publicly owned by the city of Springfield, correct?
City of Springfield, Southern Lanham Lane.
Just the farming room. All of it and majority.
And some has well fields.
There's really well fields.
So that would be just like on the right quarter there somewhere.
About how many acres are we talking about here?
Maybe 400 in the pool area.
Where's 28th Street?
So that's the two right where you just had it.
328 comes down here.
Right.
Or here.
Right there. That's 28th. It goes all the way through.
So you've got that white space is where the middle school is now, roughly.
Yeah. And Sub has well fields at the, you know, if you went all the way down to the end of 28th Street,
they're right in there. Right in there.
And pretty much all this area is within the, I'm looking at the map here, like the 1 to 5 year time of travel zone, pretty much. But then, that's not to say, I mean, the whole gateway area, you know, Royal Caribbean's right on top of the wealth.
Yeah.
I mean, you can mitigate that.
It's just, yeah.
It's a concern, for sure.
It doesn't mean you can't build there, it just means that certain things would not probably best be located.
Certain industries would not.
Yeah. You don't want a filling station or a place with a lot of resin or chemicals or
some kind of major mining operation just right up top of it.
So, what do you think in terms of potential either for residential or for commercial industrial?
There's. It could work for some mining or
there's certain kind of industrial use that could work. I mean, you know, that could be compatible with reclamation and improvement in the mill race. It's right next door to other kind of major right. industrial operations that are there already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Having hauled crops out of that farmland in there, I can tell you that crossing, that railroad crossing, that's really, really a bad thing if you're going to have any kind of emergency needs or timely access. That's not to say it can't be worked out with the railroad, but that whole 28th Street railroad complex and the crossing and the side crossings in there, it's really creates problems accessing that from Main Street.
But this site also, it just feels like it is part of an urban setting, and it's going to change no matter what we do. So if you don't bring it in the UGB, that doesn't mean other things are going to happen, because it happens all the time back there. So, but for me, that feels a little bit more integrated with the urban context in a lot of ways. So there's issues everywhere you look. But, and again, it would be good to know just how many acres. The other part of it is that it's one of the only areas that we've looked at, maybe the only area we are going to look at where there is some public ownership, and that gives you some, I think, options if you bring publicly owned property sometimes into the UGB. So with some public planning. All the other ones that we've looked at, I think I'm pretty sure they're largely in the hands of private ownership. So if the city decided with Lem Lane to do something here, it might be something that could happen sooner than, you know, 20 years away, a different kind of property.
So we go on to the last two. We can get you guys out of here. And there, I'm just going to write it all on the same thing. So there are 9 and 10. One of them, 10 is Goshen, so to the south. And 9 is the CD Booth area. So they're relatively along that I-5. We're talking about to the east of I-5. So we heard from ODOT that there's now there's limited capacity at I-5 and the 30th Street interchange. So there needs to be work, perhaps some serious work to that. We'd also need a sewer extension from Glenwood, Glenwood does have sewer, so that provides some opportunities. There's some opportunities for parkland at the river confluence area. And opportunities for some denser development, and that province has reported there's also been inquiries from commercial firms. And if you're looking at sort of the ocean, we'll be talking about more regional industrial needs rather than
big concern is trying to know what's really going to be so fine. Must be class 2. Class 1 and class 2 soils. So there's going to be an issue with that. That's flood issues, flood concerns, and wetland concerns.
Some of the soils are class, certainly class 2, I think some class 1s. There are some lower quality soils.
On the positive side, industrial commercial use, it's right next to I-5. It has some of the same value from a commercial standpoint as the gateway area. Close to 30th, close to LCC. Quite a bit of existing commercial and industrial there already.
The nexus with the existing UGB or Springfield is that little tiny, on the this side of the river is Glenwood. Right, it's Franklin Boulevard. That's it right there. Okay. So again, I'd raise a question to the technical team. If you go that far to Goshen, why not continue on past the interchange and look at all that industrial land that's just south, right down in there? I mean, it's not going to ever be connected to any other urban area. It's not going to be part of Eugene. Is it next to Eugene's UGB?
No, Eugene's. No.
So
UGB is way up here.
Yeah, but I mean, so
it's on the other side of I-5.
But it's right. Well,
in North.
Yeah, I'm just raising the question. If you establish that connection through that pinpoint up there at Franklin Boulevard, why not conceptually look at including that whole Goshen area, which has got a lot of industrials?
Well, is it possible to include that area again?
Well, I agree with Jordan's principle, but if that has limited capacity interchange, you might be able to get 100 acres of development, and you could get 400 acres of development without knowing multi-million dollar upgrade to interchange. So it may be a balancing act between acreage and number of improvements needed at interchange.
You may just want to do that. Mike, I recall, you may recall this, I don't know where it is, and ODOT had it in their fairly near-term improvement plan to improve the 30th Avenue interchange.
But the interchange I'm talking about is the one they just improved.
It's on top of the highway, just further down. Yeah. Just
you're
down
down.
Now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That doesn't, that
you're all the way down.
I think that might bump into the greater Crestwell growth problem. That's
happening. Well, my grander.
On the CB Loop one, let's pinpoint where Mount Pisgah Arboretum is. Can we do that on the map?
Go to the end of CB Loop.
Right. This is hard to read here. Okay. That's the parking lot right there. And the area on the other side. How much of the proposed, again, it's kind of hard to tell how many acres are there, but How much of that is Wildish property currently?
Wildish is really, if you go back to the aerial photograph, you can see that. Yeah, but all those greens are all gravel pits. So, I mean, that area may look attractive, but it's just not going to have, you know, a huge bunch of.
But I mean, Wildish has had plans to actually do residential stuff there.
Of course.
Well, that was met with a hail of opposition. But the residential one, it was like they were going to quit using the gravel pits. Anyway, that's something that surfaces every couple of years. But if it's included in the UGB, I mean, they had talks from time to time about their property out there coming into the UGB and being used differently than it is being used today. And some of it, I know it's great farmland, but as George said, that's not great farmland. If you go walk back there, it's wasteland. And but Wildishes, I just kind of wait for the next thing. I don't know. I just see there's some potential there. I do think it's a sensitive issue because Mount Pisgah and that whole area is, you know, it's great. You don't want to have that happen. But of course, on the other side of Mount Pisgah, that again is Wildish property that someday they could do something with.
Well, again, I'm just asking jurisdictional questions. So the area that you're talking about, Dan, is in the Metro Plan boundary in between the south and the middle fork, right? So it's kind of this Wildish area on the
Wildish ponds, right? Yeah, where the old brain
but
recycling.
I'm looking at 9 and 10 are areas that are outside the Metro Plan boundary, but east of I-5. Just kind of getting to George's question, I mean, is there any problem with us looking outside the Metro Plan boundary one? And is there anything stopping us from looking at the other side of I-5? So if we include Goshen, you know, is all of Goshen available to look at?
Wallace Creek is outside the Metro Plan boundary.
So, I mean, do we have any kind of limitation on that? Or is it just one more layer of
the Metro Plan says that, HB 337 says that we have to do our urban growth boundary without interfering with the other city's jurisdiction area responsibility as defined in the Metro Plan. Two things about that. One is the Metro Plan can be changed to redefine the jurisdictional areas any time. Currently, the jurisdictional areas are those areas inside the current urban growth boundary on the city's respective sides of I-5. So anything outside the existing urban growth boundaries, arguably, is available to either jurisdiction. Of course, it has to be a coordinated process. I mean, it's not that you claim jurisdiction.
Well, also 3337. LTC Basin, here we go.
3337 talks about establishing that as opposed to expanding it. So the coordination with the Metro Plan, opposed to 33%.
Well, except 3337 specifically references the Metro Plan's allocation of jurisdiction responsibility as the key to where the two cities establish their growth boundaries. So I see that as the kernel, you know, and basically, the basic assumption is
fair government to the process.
Huh?
Yeah, the fair government to
the process. You do. You definitely do. It gets much more complicated when you cross I-5.
So do you have any other comments about
anything else
Syria?
On this one?
Just a general comment. I know we're about to leave, and I think when we started this, it was sort of like, this is our first look, so not a lot of detail, and maybe you added a little bit today about some of the areas, but for purposes of really kind of coming to grips with what's usable and how big a spot we're looking at, and kind of questions just like that, you know, what's trying to find that compromise between trying to set up something that's darn near impossible and something that has a good chance to pass. I think with some more detail on each one of those. And I guess our job then, David, is to start eliminating a couple of these for consideration as far as a recommendation, or to just maybe comment on each one of those.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, not necessarily do you have to start eliminating things, but you know, eventually I think we want to get at prioritizing and making that as a recommendation to the council. Planning Commission. So essentially the planning commission and council, they will see all the same options you did, but then they'll hear what your recommendation is.
I have a request. I don't know if it's technically possible, but for those of us who aren't on a high-speed internet connection, if you guys could do thumbnails of these or have a link to a folder where they maybe weren't at the highest resolution, so we can at least look and see which ones we want to spend a long time downloading, that would be.
How about a website?
Yeah.
Well,
I'll see what we can do for you.
Yeah.
I'm sure we can do something.
Yeah, we'll make it.
Could you make an DVD?
We can make a CD.
Yeah, I mean, make it cost effective. That's pretty cheap.
Yeah.
Mike,
good question. And if there's not answers tonight, that's okay. But if we come up with a figure, 600 or 700 acres that's needed for commercial industrial, 20-year horizon, we seem to like priority area one best, let's say, for that. That's 650 acres or 480 acres or whatever. And we like priority area two next best. And that's 550 acres. Then we like priority area three, another 500 acres. We're talking about 650 acres amongst 1,700 acres in the top three priorities. So is that as far as we go, or do we say no? Do we go further than that and say we got 640 acres to allocate? We like these, we like 200 acres in about this area, and 200 acres over through here, and 200 acres over through here.
It's more like what you just said, Mark. And I think it's, when we started looking at good farmland, which is zoned for farming use, and not always the same. Sometimes good farmland is zoned for rural residential. We have to have very specific criteria. Remember the Woodbury case, about exactly what we think that good farmland is good for. And I think we're not quite there yet. It isn't just a matter of 650 acres and peeling away, but farmland, very specific criteria, very good reason for that. And I really want to underscore something that Lee said is, when I used to live around here, I used to commute these waters a fair bit. There's a lot of real wet stuff out there, not just flood wetland, it's full of wetland plants. And I think that we need to do some kind of mapping of that, because if we end up relying on wet stuff to meet our future industrial needs or residential needs, and it becomes too expensive to develop, and we've dug ourselves in a hole.
We had very few wetlands. We had some damp lands.
That was the old days, Mike. We got lands.
Eugene wouldn't be here if we had.
I think what Mike was suggesting, it would be helpful, and maybe this is asking for too much, but we've been talking some pretty generic, how about this big area? It would be helpful to me, I don't know if others, if staff came back, would, in terms of the options, would kind of give us some suggestions of some specific site alternatives of sizing and what's developable of that.
You know, and further, if there's a way, I mean, it's helpful to have all these different maps. We've got one layer that has hydro soils and one that has slopes and all. It'd be easier if we could kind of look at the inverse of these and overlay and say, where are the areas that have, you know, marginal lands, cruddy soils, aren't too steep, you know, and you kind of can tease out sort of the more developable areas more easily that way. So I wonder if you kind of invert that, some of these layers on there.
Yeah, and actually, I know these guys have done it before. It was actually done in McMinnville. I've done it before. You just put the overlays, and it's kind of the good, bad, and the ugly, you know, or the in-between, and then you can make better choices that way, I think, too.
Okay, so I think we've sort of been going through the next steps.
I did want to add in just something, I guess, personal for me, where it's going to affect my position. My wife and I are expecting our second child here, actually, January 22nd, so it's at our next.
All right.
So,
you don't need to be
impossible then. I'm pretty all night here, so anyways, I may or may not be at our next meeting, but the reason why I'm telling you as well is, just to give you a heads up, you may be receiving an email from another staff person who may, you know, help lead this through the next meeting or next 2 weeks. So,
Congratulations. Nice time for duty.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Well.